like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and this is a recorded version of Talking Animals, once again produced remotely at the corporate headquarters in Jupiter Farms, Florida. And, as a reminder, we're in the final 2 hours of the Giving Challenge, so if you'd like to pledge in support of Talking Animals, or of course any other WMNF show, we just happen to be in the midst of Talking Animals, by calling 813-238-8001, any donation between $25 and $100 will be doubled. Sweet! What's not to like? Today's edition of the show will feature two interviews I recorded in recent days. The first, which I'll air in just a moment, is with Karen Davis, founder of United Poultry Concerns, UPC, an organization founded in 1990 that promotes the compassionate and respectful treatment of domestic fowl. As UPC marks its 30th anniversary, having seen over the years a number of its campaigns gain traction, yielding, among other results, increased awareness of the horrors chickens experience in factory farming settings, a surge in the number of people who keep chickens in their backyards, and a more recent upturn in folks who live with chickens in their homes. In this conversation, Davis and I discuss how two cultural figures, and incidentally, major radio masters, provided significant boosts to UPC. One of those is Ira Glass, host of This American Life, and we'll hear that story, including how Davis made a Letterman appearance that included telling Dave about visiting Davis and the UPC sanctuary and how that visit transformed him into a vegetarian. She also recounts how Harry Shearer, longtime host of the radio program Le Show, veteran voice actor on The Simpsons and star of Spinal Tap, offered inspiration for the creation of International Respect for Chickens Day, which is this Monday, May 4th, the 15th anniversary of the event. We'll hear those stories, as well as about Davis's formative years, growing up amidst a family where hunting was a central activity, as well as the genesis of United Poultry Concerns when I play back the interview with Karen Davis in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll air another interview I recorded recently, this one with Natalia Lima, who owns the Curious Cat Bakery, a St. Petersburg vegan bakery she decided to devote full time to, leaving a job in animal welfare to do so, not long before the pandemic hit. We talked about everything from how she got into baking, some of her bakery's specialties, how she's had to adapt her business in the COVID-19 era, and more. Right now, though, let's play back the interview with Karen Davis about United Poultry Concerns, International Respect for Chickens Day and Month, among a number of other topics. Recorded last Thursday, this is Karen Davis on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals, Karen.
Thank you, Duncan. I'm delighted to be on your show today.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, you've carved out a pretty specific niche in the animal welfare world when you founded United Poultry Concerns some 30 years ago. And really, UPC still occupies a pretty singular position. So in a moment, I want to delve in all sorts of specifics about UPC, including its early years and mission and how the organization may have evolved. But first, let's find out about you and your history and what you were doing before you launched UPC. So let's go all the way back for a ways, just initially. Where did you grow up, and what role did animals play when you were a kid?
Okay, well, let's see. I grew up in Altoona, Pennsylvania. When I grew up, Altoona was still a railroad town. I grew up in an environment where my father and my brothers and uncles and everybody in the whole county, Blair County, went hunting, sport hunting, really. And even from the earliest years that I can remember, I felt an aversion to, a deep sympathetic aversion to the killing of rabbits, squirrels, and birds, pheasant hunting, which really is just canned hunting, because the pheasants are hand-raised, and then they're set out of their pens to be shot just for pleasure, really. So that's the kind of atmosphere I grew up in. And as I, got older and learned more, of course, when I was younger, around the age of 13, I would start fighting with my father at the dinner table about hunting, while at the same time, I was unthinkingly eating animals, and it took a little while longer for me to make that connection between animals and meat. So, but eventually I kind of just moved into a sphere of deep concern for animals and a definite aversion to mistreating them, and certainly mistreating and killing them for pleasure.
Well, we'll maybe expand on that in a moment or two, but just back to the childhood days, one probably rhetorical, maybe even ridiculous question. Was there ever any thought in the family when your dad and brothers were going off hunting that you would go as well? Did they ever ask you to go or give you the option to go? Or?
Well, actually, since you asked that question, my father would kind of teasingly say to me, you know, why don't you just come along with us for the walk, you know, through the woods? And, of course, I wouldn't dream of going on a walk with people with guns who were shooting animals, shooting squirrels and birds and so on. So my answer to that was no. And I think it was, frankly, a kind of sadistic pleasure that my father got out of taunting me in that way.
Yeah.
But of course I never went. But I do remember one time when I was taking a walk with one of my brothers and my father, and it was in the woods, and it was the day before the opening of ringneck pheasant hunting season. And I remember my brother saying to my father, because they had visited the farm that raises these pheasants that morning, and my brother said to my father, I just wish when we had visited that farm that I had had my gun. And I got so choked up, I thought I was going to suffocate on the trail.
Wow.
Because it was just such a horrible idea, and it was so sickening, and I really lost my breath and thought I was never going to be able to breathe again. So my response to all of that goes back really to my infancy. I always loved birds, had a deep affection for dogs. And of course, in my family, you had hunting dogs, and then you had your pet dog who lived in the house. And these were treated in totally different ways, because the beagles, who the so-called hunting dogs, were really punished into fear and tractability, whereas the dogs who lived in the house, the spaniel or the terrier or whoever it may have been at the time, was treated just the opposite, with tender, loving care. So
wow.
There was that dichotomy that I also experienced growing up in Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Well, I was going to ask you about pets, but that answers the question and then some in terms of the sort of division of canines in the household or outside of the household, really. And do you think, Karen, that you were maybe sort of precociously attuned to animals and just sensitive to them? Because it sounds like, from what you've described so far at least, that you were odd woman out or black sheep or whatever the right term is within your family. But part of that was that you, it sounds like very early on, 13 or even younger, it sounds like it was younger, really plugged into animals and how they should be treated and how they should not be treated. And meanwhile, you were amongst a family of hunters.
Right, hunters, and my father training, so-called training, the beagles, the succession of beagles who were brought onto our property, and it was just very abusive, and it was very painful to me, and from a very young age. And one of the strongest experiences I had when I was very, very young was when a baby bird would fall out of a nest, let's say a robin, because we had a lot of robins in those days in our yard and everywhere else around. So occasionally, an unfledged or partially fledged, feathered, that is, baby bird would fall out of a robin's nest, and I would actually get sick with anxiety about that bird. And my mother would always say, well, we'll take care of the bird, and we'll, you know, do our best. And there was this understanding, I don't know, still know if it's correct, that if you put a baby bird who has fallen out of a nest back into the nest, the mother bird will reject the bird. So I don't know if that's true or not. But the thing is, the following day, the baby bird was always gone. And another experience I had was when our neighbor had a pet duck, a pet white Pekin duck, and her children played with the duck, and we played with the duck, and the duck was just part of the family up the road from where we lived. And then one day I heard that duck had been run over on the road, and I really remember that, because I lay on the sofa and just cried and cried and cried over that pet duck, and it just seemed so particularly horrible that a duck would be run over by a car. So I have experiences like that growing up, and so I would say, in answer to your question, that I compared to other people in my family, certainly, and maybe other people in a lot of other families, I had a precocious empathy and sympathy for animals and an inborn hatred of watching them suffer or knowing about their suffering, and particularly suffering that was caused intentionally.
Yeah, well, that's obviously, I guess, been a part of your narrative through the rest of your life up till the moment we're speaking and beyond.
Really, and then my father, you know, when I would challenge him about rabbit hunting and shooting animals in the back and all of that, he'd say, oh, hell, girl, everything hunts the rabbit. That was his definitive response. Okay, yeah. Since everything hunts the rabbit, then there's nothing more to say about it. So
that
was kind of how things were. And my father continued hunting well into his 80s, long after he could barely see anything. But he still went out with his gun. You know, that never changed. And for that matter, Altoona, Pennsylvania, as far as I know, still closes all of its schools on the first day of deer hunting season. So, you know, not much has changed back there.
Yeah, no, that's just a very specific kind of sensibility that sounds remarkably unchanged over all those years. Well, so, Karen, I guess I'm very curious, given what you later ended up doing and what we're here partly to talk about today, is I'd like to know, when exactly did a specific bird first appeal to you or make some kind of connection or you with it, and why?
Are you talking about chickens and turkeys?
Well, early on, like if there was a formative experience where there was a specific bird, even not necessarily chicken or turkey, or later, just whenever there was something that really took hold in your heart within some sort of bird that may also account for what the rest of the Karen Davis narrative seems to be influenced by.
Well, as I said a few minutes ago, I grew up with a deep empathy for and affinity for birds.
Yeah.
Robins, blue jays, the birds who appeared in our yard. And I did not grow up around chickens. And it was many years after this incident occurred when I was a child that the memory came back to me all of a sudden, having been repressed, apparently, for decades. And that was where I was visiting my best friend in elementary school named Betsy Folk, and I would visit her at her home all the time, and she would visit us up, you know, we're just up the road from each other. And I clearly remembered a day when we were at her home, and her father reached under the house into like a shed that I don't recall even having been aware existed, and he pulled out a brown hen. I know it was a hen. I can still see this bird. And he lay her head on a chopping block and cut her head off with a hatchet.
Oh my God.
And I still remember the face of this bird lying there on the ground clucking while the body ran around before it finally succumb to its death. And, you know, people make fun of that, and that, like, that's funny, a chicken with its head cut off. But I can tell you that for anybody who has any sensitivity at all, there's nothing humorous at all about that. And as I say, the experience was obviously so devastating to me that I repressed the memory for many, many years, decades actually, until one day the image and the experience came back to me with clarity. And so that was certainly another experience that I had. Everything about birds has always appealed to me, but that particular experience with that chicken was the only one that I can recall having other as a child, other than when my parents got two Easter chicks. Again, I was very young then and didn't know anything about chickens, except that my mother always bragged about how she got the chickens that we ate from a local slaughterhouse. But I just didn't register all of that at the time.
Sure.
Food was still, for me, what was placed on a plate.
Yeah.
Was something that I didn't relate to as having been an animal, for which I, in that regard, I was not precocious at all.
Right.
I'm sorry to say.
Well, there's just not much questioning that goes on at that stage.
Sorry, what?
There's just not much questioning that goes on. It's just like, as you say, it's served on a plate, and that's what's for dinner, and you proceed from there. It's only later where some questions start to really nag if you're so inclined.
Right, exactly. But again, I just, when I finally finally did meet a chicken, an actual chicken. Well, I started to tell you about the two baby chicks who my parents brought into the house, into the kitchen at one Easter when I was very young.
Yeah.
And then the two chicks disappeared, and my mother said, well, we sent them to a farm where they'll live happily ever after. Well, the farm happened to be my father. My father is a lawyer, was a lawyer. He's since passed away. He had a law partner named Bob Haverstroh, who had like a hobby farm in Bedford, Pennsylvania. And so one day we went to this hobby farm, and we went into this dark, another shed, like a barn. It was very dark in there, and there were a whole lot of young white chickens. And my mother said, or my father maybe it was, who said, oh, there are the two chickens who we brought to the farm here from, you know, from Easter. Now, of course, they were just saying that because they couldn't pick out one chicken from another, and they all looked the same. So that was another experience I had with birds growing up.
Yeah.
But it really wasn't until decades later when I was quite a bit older that I actually met a chicken, and I've told her story, and it's right on our homepage, and it's the story of the little crippled hen I named Viva, or my husband actually at the time, who has also passed away since then, but he named her Viva because the flock, the little flock of about 100 birds that our landlady was raising at that time in the mid-1980s, in order to retain her tax benefit, not having to pay taxes because she was still classified as an agricultural entity. So I met these chickens in a little old ramshackle shed there one day when my husband and I rented this this small house in outside Washington, D.C. in Maryland. So I would visit these chickens every day, and I'd take a magazine or a book to read in the middle of the afternoon, and I was just very moved by them and how they would be at the little door by the second day of my coming down the path, and this was in June in 1985, and they seemed so glad to have me there, and they would surround me while I would be reading, and they were just so friendly, and then one day they were all gone. And so later that day or the next day, I was walking by the shed, and I saw some feathers kind of floating around in there, and I went inside the shed, and I was looking around, and I saw that under a shelf that was full of a lot of old rusted farm equipment, there was a chicken who had been left behind when the others had been gathered up and sent to slaughter. And so she was very crippled, and she was very dirty, and she was very small compared to those other ones. And I figured that either she was left behind because she was so small and considered not marketable, or she was left behind because she simply was overlooked. But I gathered her up in my arms, and I took her back to the little house we were renting, and I placed her on a blanket on the kitchen floor, and my husband and I looked at her, and my husband, Alan Kate, said, you know, we should name her Viva because she was the one who lived. And Viva was absolutely instrumental and foundational in my ultimate decision 5 years later to found United Poultry Concerns, which I've been running now for 30 years since 1990.
Yeah.
But my experience with Viva just fit so well into the lifelong affinity I had always had for birds. And so when I met a chicken, she was a bird, and I just really loved her from the very moment I saw her and brought her into our house. Eventually, she was so crippled that she actually started to get wounds, black and blue wounds, inside her wings and on the inside of her legs. And I had no idea at the time what I was really dealing with. And so I took her to a veterinarian in College Park, Maryland, who looked at her and said, well, her condition was responsible for these wounds, and that she was not really going to recover. She was only going to get worse. So the veterinarian recommended that she be euthanized, and I was very conflicted about this, but I ended up succumbing to the veterinarian's advice, which I now regret, but that's the story that can be read right on our homepage, as I said, Viva the chicken hen, the little hen who started it all, by it all, meaning really my love for chickens and my ultimate decision to start United Poultry Concerns, focusing on the plight and the delight of chickens, turkeys, and other domesticated fowl, referring to those birds who have the misfortune to be considered a food source for humans.
Well, this might be the exact time to say this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Karen Davis, the founder and president of United Poultry Concerns, which again promotes the compassionate and respectful treatment of domestic fowl. This conversation is in recognition that Monday is International Respect for Chickens Day, and this conversation was recorded Thursday. Viva sounds like central to the launching of United Poultry Concerns. So right between the time that Viva came into your life and before you decided to indeed launch United Poultry Concerns, what else? Were there some other pivotal things that happened? And once you were starting to think about creating United Poultry Concerns, when you told friends and colleagues about your idea for this new organization, what sort of responses did it generate?
Well, Duncan, I kind of got two different responses. On the one hand, there were those who told me that an organization focusing on the plight of chickens and turkeys would never fly because it was hard enough, as one person said, one animal rights person said at the time in the late 1980s, it's hard enough to get people to care about whales. We can't even get people to care sufficiently about whales. Mm. How on the earth do you think you could ever get people to care about chickens and turkeys? And of course, my response was, well, as an animal advocate, that is my job, to write and speak and do everything I can in such a way as to bring these birds sympathetically into the consciousness of people so that people, even who thought they didn't care or would never care about chickens and turkeys, actually revise their attitude. And that has been my experience through all these years of running United Poultry Concerns. Of course, there are people who are resistant and aren't responsive to the message. But I've also experienced situations where a person came back to me and said, you know, when I first heard you talk about chickens, I thought how crazy that is. But then I changed my mind. And one of the best examples of that experience is Ira Glass, the host of This American Life on National Public Radio.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. And so that now that we're there, we might as well hear about it, because I think that's, to me, one of the many great things about you and what you've done all these years is that there's inevitably going to be some people who don't take UPC and its mission seriously, and there's teasing or mocking or whatever there might be. But you've always had good humor, I think, about that, and found a way to make really lemonade out of lemons. And I think the perfect example is the Ira Glass story. So, yeah, by all means, if you wouldn't mind sharing that with us now, that'd be great.
Sure. And let me just say this. There were the other people in the movement, the other leaders at the time, some of them are still with us, who were just the opposite, who urged me to start the organization. And in fact, one head of an organization, farmed animal organization, said, do it and do it now. So he was very adamant that this was an important organization that I was contemplating. And I have to say that one way or the other, I was going to start this organization, but I was just sounding people out. But there, no matter if everybody had told me it was not going to work, I would have still started United Poultry Concerns, because that was my decision and that was it. But getting to Ira Glass, for a long time, several years in the mid-2000s, Ira Glass and This American Life ran what they called a poultry slam, based on the idea of the poetry slam. So between Thanksgiving and Christmas each year, they would run this show, which featured several different narrative voices talking about chickens, turkeys, and ducks, and always in a rather sarcastic and dismissive way. And this was supposed to be amusing and humorous. And when I would listen to this show, as well as to previous shows that you could listen to online, I found the whole tone of the shows to be very, very mean-spirited and also inaccurate, because by that time I was running United Poultry Concerns, which includes a sanctuary for chickens, turkeys, and ducks. So I had intimate acquaintance with these birds by the mid-2000s, and I'm listening to these voices making stereotypical comments about the stupidity of chickens and turkeys and ducks and so on, and all this nonsense. And I could match what they were saying against the experience that I was having each and every single day at our sanctuary and continue to have at this very moment where we still have our sanctuary now in Virginia. So I contacted This American Life and specifically Ira Glass, and we formed a campaign urging our members to contact Ira Glass and send him pictures and stories about their chickens or their turkeys and ducks. But we really wanted to focus on chickens because they bore the brunt of all the disparagement that was being rehearsed on this particular Poultry Slam episode.
Yeah.
So eventually I got a call from the producer of This American Life who asked me if I would like to be one of the voices on the show that year. And I said I would consider that only on the understanding that Ira Glass would first visit our sanctuary and meet our chickens and see who they are compared to how they're being misrepresented by these various people on the Poultry Slam.
Yeah.
And so Ira Glass, he took up the challenge, and he came down here to our sanctuary, which we had by then brought down from Maryland into Virginia and on the eastern shore of Virginia. And he spent the afternoon here, and of course he and I had long conversation about our work and about the birds. But he also spent a considerable amount of time outside in the sanctuary, and then ultimately, in, I believe it was 2007, he was a guest on the David Letterman show,
mm-hmm.
and he talked about how he had met this woman named Karen Davis who ran this organization for chickens,
yeah.
and how we had launched this campaign against the Poultry Slam, and how he had learned that we were an organization that opposed eating chickens, and he said, to David Letterman, at the time, he said, I thought, how ridiculous, you know? Chicken consumption is an Armageddon. How is this little group ever going to possibly make any headway, given the state of things where chicken consumption is concerned? That little segment, which runs for several minutes, where Ira Glass is talking to David Letterman, and of course in front of millions of viewers, both on television and in the live audience, the show is structured in such a way that what seems to be funny at the beginning, and the audience is laughing at everything, eventually becomes more serious, to the point where David Letterman finally said to Ira Glass, well then, after your experience meeting these chickens and discovering they have individual personalities and they have feelings and so forth, did you become a vegetarian? And Ira Glass said, well, yes, I did. He said, for a while, every time I would eat a piece of chicken, I felt guilty about it, and eventually I stopped eating them and became vegetarian. So for me, Ira Glass's change of heart and his experience meeting our chickens is a kind of epitome of experience that I have had through the years, where somebody who at first was kind of dismissive and even sarcastic about chicken rights and caring about chickens and so on, actually did change their minds. It might take a little while, but many people come round, and it's very heartening when I meet somebody who says, you know, when I met you, I thought, oh, you know, this is ridiculous, but what you had to say stuck in my mind, and I'm happy to tell you that not only am I vegetarian now, but when I really realized how, you know, how cruelly hens used for egg production and cows for milk production are treated, so now I'm vegan.
Yeah.
So that is, you know, the best news anybody can give me.
First, there's a few things I really like about that story. I mean, one is, although we sort of gave away the ending of the movie in a way, that clip is on your website, which again is upc-online.org, but it really builds because, as you kind of alluded to, I mean, you don't really quite know where Ira Glass is going, but it certainly starts off like, yeah, there's this kind of nutty organization and this nutty lady who's raising a stink about what we do on the show. And then it really evolves from there. And then the thing that Dave, as I recall, said, he didn't necessarily ask specifically, did you go vegetarian? I think he said, like, did it change your dietary habits. So to me, it was such a great sort of twist, a story twist. And again, Ira Glass had great humor about his transformation. But also, again, as I said when we first talked about telling that story, I mean, the fact of how you handled it, I think, is critical, because there's just so many people that are activists and animal activists, obviously, in particular, that are humorless or just sometimes are just so like focused that they're kind of shrill, and that they can almost do more harm than good sometimes. So you found a way here, yeah, while you were writing in and saying, hey, we don't really like the way the chickens and other poultry are portrayed on This American Life, instead of just being hard-nosed about it and just like no room to have a dialogue, inviting him to come, and then of course he had the presence to come and take that invitation up, but that totally switched things around.
And yes, it did. It did.
Yeah. So I just,
yes, and he was a very nice, very good guest to have. You know, yeah. It was good to meet him, and Ira Glass is from Baltimore, but so he kind of knows the Mid-Atlantic area here. But he wasn't familiar with chickens. You know, he was just kind of allowing, or really turkeys and ducks, he was just kind of allowing these voices to say what they wanted to say, which was derisive. And until our campaign, I don't think it ever occurred to him that there was another perspective on these birds,
yeah,
which we gave him. And not only me, but the many people who wrote to him, sent photos of their chickens, and explained to him things about them or told anecdotes about them that got his attention. So it worked out very well, because we wanted him to see chickens in a new light and to understand that there was a difference between how they were being portrayed on the Poultry Slam and who they are in themselves. I mean, when he came to our sanctuary, he's seeing our chickens dust bathing and sunbathing and enjoying themselves. You know, they're just pretty innocent, and this heap of derision that they are subjected to in so many different venues has nothing to do really with who they are in themselves. So
right.
He saw that, and he was gracious enough to not only change his mind, but to help change the mind of many other people.
Yeah, it was really significant in all kinds of ways. And so right now, I just want to make sure we have time to hit some of our other key things here before we run short on time, Karen. So it seems like we're in a time of UPC anniversaries, as you noted earlier. The 30th anniversary of the organization itself is happening this year. And if I'm not mistaken, we're mere days away from marking the 15th anniversary of International Respect for Chickens Day. And not coincidentally, May is International Respect for Chickens Month. So tell me about the genesis for International Respect for Chicken Day.
I'm going to tell you, because I wrote it down way back in 2005.
Right.
On April 27th, 2005, we announced the first International Respect for Chickens Day.
Yeah.
We celebrate chickens. We're urging everyone to do an action of compassion for chickens on that day. And then we expanded it to the entire month of May, and by extension, every day. But the idea for International Respect for Chickens Day goes back to the host of Le Show, LESHOW, radio show, and the star of The Simpsons, and a star of that wonderful film, This Is Spinal Tap, Harry Shearer, who on May 14th, 2000, proclaimed Sunday that year, which was Mother's Day, he proclaimed it National Respect for Chickens Day, because, he explained, hens are justly praised as exemplars of devoted motherhood. And when I heard that, and of course we wrote to him and told him how much we appreciated his making that point about mother hens and how absolutely true it is that they are kind of viewed as an epitome of nurturing and protective and attentive motherhood. And so that evolved eventually to what became International Respect for Chickens Day, officially May 4th of 2005. And so every year since then, we have had International Respect for Chickens Day, month of May, in which we ask people to do something on behalf of chickens to engage the public. And we explain that we want people to celebrate chickens throughout the world, as well as to protest the bleakness, the sorrow and misery of their lives in farming operations. So we say to people, ideas, and particularly we're talking to animal advocates, ideas include leafleting on a busy street corner, holding an office party or classroom celebration, writing a letter to the editor, doing radio call-ins, tabling at your local church or school or shopping mall, hosting a vegan open open house or simply talking to family, friends, or strangers about the plight and the delight of chickens and how people can help them. So every year, people from around the world do something special for chickens on or around May 4th. And we've been very delighted with the success of this project, this campaign. And, of course, every year since then, we have always been at the White House leafleting for chickens on an afternoon in May. And this year, because of the coronavirus pandemic, we are still waiting to hear from the National Park Service as to whether we're going to be able to do that this year. So we're not sure if we're going to be able to do it this year, certainly probably not in May. But in any case, we are doing a podcast that we're going to be broadcasting on International Respect for Chickens Day this year, and we're actually making the podcast tomorrow featuring me and created by our wonderful projects manager, Hope Bohannock, who is in California. So we all are also running bus ads, both cards within the buses and big posters on the outside of the buses in Minneapolis in May. So that's another thing that we do every year for International Respect for Chickens Day. We choose one or two cities that where we will take advantage of their transit service and post wonderful, beautiful images of chickens. And at Thanksgiving, we do the same for turkeys. But this year, to fit into the coronavirus situation, our message is kindness is contagious. Wash your hands of animal suffering. Live vegan. And we have some beautiful images of the chickens, so we're hoping that these bus ads will have an effect in Minneapolis. And of course, we will post them on our website, and they'll be out there on the internet for all to see. And right now, people in various places are ordering posters from us and doing various things they're going to do online. And eventually, once May 4th arrives or is over, then we'll start hearing from people about what they did or are doing for International Respect for Chickens Day, month of May. And we will post everything that is reported to us on our International Respect for Chickens Day webpage.
Well, that's great, Karen, and we have probably just about a minute or so left, so I want to say a couple of quick things and maybe ask you a quick question. But one, just as an observation, it's interesting and notable, I think, that a couple of key things that have happened for or about United Poultry Concerns are tied to a couple of major cultural figures. So if you've got Ira Glass, we already covered in some detail, and I hadn't known about the Harry Shearer element, but obviously a major cultural figure as well. So again, sometimes it just takes somebody like that to kind of amplify an important message that's been sitting there for a while, but it really can take off and be spread on a whole different level with a little boost from somebody like that.
So. Right. Well, we were very happy with Harry Shearer because he actually was, you know, had positive things to say about chickens on his show. So he gave us the idea of actually turning that into a an annual campaign, which we did.
Yeah.
Subsequently.
Well, I just, unfortunately, we are really near the end of our time. One thing I would have said, and I so quickly say the abridged version of, in terms of talking about some other efforts or campaigns over all these 30 years of United Poultry Concerns, I mean, one thing that seems really clear to me, and I'm sure even more clear to you, is that the public in some ways, or a portion of it, has really kind of caught up in a way, because there's been this significant surge in folks who keep chickens, not just in backyards, which has happened, obviously, to varying degrees for a while, but also inside their homes. Which I think at least is indirectly, if not directly, a byproduct of the messaging and the campaigns and just what you've kind of put out into the ether and the culture for these 30 years.
Well, I certainly think now I've also written several books about the chicken and the turkey industry and about chickens and turkeys themselves.
Sure.
The most recent one, For the Birds, was published in a compilation of essays I've written over the years, which came out in 2019, last year, by Lantern Books. And I feel that our organization has done, well, I know for a fact that our organization has had a huge impact on the animal advocacy community, who has really taken up the championship for chickens, certainly the farmed animal community. And chickens are now very, very popular among many different people, groups of people within the animal advocacy movement and community. But there are many micro sanctuaries that now focus exclusively on giving homes to rescue chickens. And in the general population, I do think that's slow, too slow, way too slow. But there is beginning of an appreciation for chickens. You mentioned the backyard chicken keeping phenomenon, which has pluses and minuses to it. Certainly, chickens kind of went from being so totally anonymous until the early 1990s when we started. And then since then, the interest in chickens in our movement and slowly kind of seeping into the general public domain has been happening. And of course, we're also very delighted to see how the plant-based food interest is developing. So we're hoping that these things together are going to make a difference for these birds, a positive difference for these birds. And that's what we work to accomplish.
For sure. Well,
we don't hope for the best. We work for the best.
That's great. Yeah. And if we had had more time, one of the things I definitely hope to discuss with you was just the idea that, for example, KFC now offering Beyond Meat, quote unquote, chicken. And yeah, so many advances in that way. But we are at the end of our time. So we've been speaking with Karen Davis, founder, president of United Poultry Concerns. The website is upc-online.org. And again, it's rich with all kinds of great information, including when you were talking about the micro sanctuaries. There's a whole page that lists all the sanctuaries with links. That's just one example of tons of great information that you can find there. So Karen, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals and all your great work on behalf of all our fowl friends over these 30 plus years.
Duncan, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you for having me on your show today. I'm very grateful.
Thank you. My thanks again to Karen Davis, and of course you still have a few days to ponder what you'd like to do in recognition of International Respect for Chickens Day. Right now, let's move right into hearing my conversation with Natalia Lima about various aspects of the Curious Cat Bakery on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Thanks for having me.
First, let's talk for a second about the hat you were wearing when I got to know you a bit before you dove all the way into the bakery. What were you doing?
Right. So before, when I met you, I was working as a publicist for a national animal protection organization called the Animal Legal Defense Fund.
And how did you wander into that kind of work, just briefly?
Oh, briefly. Briefly,
we can hear the long version. I just meant that we're mainly here to talk about the bakery.
The long
so
version.
Yeah.
There's not enough time.
Okay, all right.
I have a degree in journalism, and I always loved animals. I'm vegan. I was always trying to save a dog or a cat, whenever I could. So I started working with local animal rescues. I worked with Friends of Strays here in St. Pete for a while. And then eventually kind of started working with ALDF as a freelancer, helping them out with their publicity department.
Yeah.
And eventually was brought on full time.
That's great. How long were you there before you made your...
It was about 4 years, I think.
Okay, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so now let's... That was briefly. I didn't mean to say briefly in a rude way. I just meant that, we're here to talk about bakery, and that you might be thinking, hey, why are we tracking my career history before we got into the bakery when we just have a short time to talk about the bakery part? But anyways, all right, so how did your foray into vegan baking begin? What prompted it?
So I started the bakery because I needed to, honestly. So I went vegan about 10 years ago, and back then, it was rough. There were no good cakes or cupcakes or sweets out there. Everything just tasted dry and sad, and I've always loved sweets my whole life, so right. I was just like, this is not going to cut it for the rest of my life. This
yeah.
is not going to work.
Yeah.
So I never baked in my life. I never grew up baking, but I just needed to figure out a solution for this. So I just started playing around, Googling and trying to find new recipes, adapting some of the ones that I found in cookbooks. And then eventually I got to this point where I had stuff that tasted just like the real deal. And I would take it to my friends' houses for a birthday party, or an event, and people would be like, "This is vegan? Are you serious?
Wow.
I can't believe this. This is amazing." And so that's when I knew, there's something here. Like, if I can make something that tastes just as good as a regular cookie or as a regular cake, and it's vegan, I can get people who aren't vegan to want to try it.
Yeah. So it sounds like, in recounting the story, that a key element was that you have always had a sweet tooth. So if you didn't, if you didn't have that sweet tooth, then you wouldn't have been as disappointed about what your initial experience with vegan desserts were, and you wouldn't have said, hey, this ain't working for me. I got to fix this just for my own sake.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing for me. Like, I am my biggest critic in terms of, like, I just love desserts. For me, every meal is not complete without a dessert.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how full you are. You need to have that sweet, you know, course at the end.
Sure.
So for me, it was about satisfying, you know, this person who loves dessert. And I know that there are other people out there who are in the same shoes as I am.
For sure.
And I even meet them today, you know, and they will come to me and be like, you know, I've been searching for something good for so long. I've been vegan for so many years. And I was like, yeah, I got you.
Yeah. So when you kind of started experimenting and then you took them to birthday parties or friends' other, you know, houses for one thing or another, I mean, was there a particular moment when things clicked and you thought, hey, this might be a venture, a business thing for me? Was there a particular moment of that, or was it more cumulative from just taking it to a few different friends' house and starting to think, hey, maybe I'm onto something here?
Yeah, it was more of that. It was just, you know, seeing that a lot of my friends who are not vegan kept asking for it. Can you bring those cookies? Can you bring those pecan cookies? Can you bring that cake that you made last time?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, you are not even vegan and you're asking for it. So I started seeing it not as a business, but more of an opportunity to advocate for animals in a different way.
Oh,
because
wow.
At the time, I was happy in the job that I had. I wasn't trying to look for something new.
Right.
And then it just evolved into something much bigger than I could have ever imagined.
Yeah. Well, isn't that how some of the coolest things do for people come together? It's like they almost stumble into it, and then it's like, holy cow, I wasn't really looking for a new job or a new professional direction, but here we are.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what sort of baked goods do you offer? First of all, we should say that it's the Curious Cat Bakery that we're talking about. And so what sort of baked goods does the Curious Cat Bakery offer?
So all kinds of vegan desserts. So cakes, cupcakes, cookies, some sweet breads like cinnamon rolls, all the croissants now I just started, all kinds of sweet desserts.
Wow. And are there things you would consider Curious Cat specialties?
Well, the pecan cookies that I mentioned before is everyone's favorite.
Okay.
And then recently, I also added to the menu a salted chocolate chip cookie that has been insane. Like, people cannot get enough of those.
Wow. So every step of the way, obviously at the beginning, but every step of the way since, you've basically just kind of been self-taught and you just experimented and just said, okay, let me figure out how to make this insane salted chocolate chip cookie, and then you did it.
Yeah, it's strange. And people ask me, like, where do you get these ideas? I'm like, I dream about them sometimes. Like, this is my life now.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. But just be like, you know, salted chocolate chip cookies. That sounds like a good idea.
Sure.
Yeah, and then I just play around with them, do some research, and adapt other recipes that I know or that I get inspired by, and it's always playing around. If I'm not making orders for people, I'm in my own kitchen just experimenting and trying to come up with new ones.
So will you custom make items? Like, let's say I said to you, hey, Natalia, can you bake me a vegan red velvet cake? What would you say to that?
Yeah, I always encourage customers, like, if you go to the website and you can't find the specific flavor that you're looking for, go ahead and send me an email and let's see if we can work it out. And most times we can figure it out.
Because it's like a kind of a cool puzzle, really, that you're solving. Like, hey, I don't offer this yet. I've never made this before, but I've taught myself how to do everything else. And this customer really wants a red velvet cake, let's say, or whatever. Let me figure out how to solve it.
Exactly. Yeah. And it is a challenge. And, you know, veganizing stuff is not always easy. There are some puzzles that I haven't been able to figure out. Like, I keep getting requests for tiramisu, and I'm like, I'm trying, you know, but.
Request for, like, what? Sorry, I missed that. Request for what?
Tiramisu.
Oh, tiramisu. Okay. I gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. And I haven't been able to figure that one out yet, and I refuse to put anything out there that is not just like the real deal. So it was very recently that I added brownies, for example, because that one, you know, you have, what, 5 or 6 eggs in a brownie?
Yeah.
You know, it's not easy to replicate. So only recently did I get it to a point where I was like, okay, this tastes just like a real brownie, you know, and then I added it to the menu. So
here's the obvious question along the way is, tell me about the name. I'm curious about Curious Cat. How did you decide to call your bakery the Curious Cat Bakery?
So I'm a crazy cat lady.
Okay.
And I love cats. And one of my cats, her name is Magic. She was actually adopted from Friends of Strays here in St. Pete.
Nice.
And she's a black cat, and she's on the logo because her tail is always in a question mark. She will just walk around, and ever since we got her from day one, she's always so curious about everything. She's always sniffing around, and whenever I would experiment in the kitchen and I would bake, she would come around and just look at it like she was trying to learn it. So she is the curious cat.
I gotcha. Cool. Well, this, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Natalia Lima, who owns the St. Petersburg vegan bakery called The Curious Cat Bakery. This conversation was recorded last Wednesday. How do things work as a Curious Cat customer in the midst of the COVID-19 era? How do people go about ordering or getting their baked goods from you?
Right. Things have to change a little bit, because before I used to do markets pretty much every weekend, and people would come and, you know, buy their stuff in person. Remember those things?
Those were the days, right?
Yeah. Those were the days.
Yeah.
But now we obviously can't do that in the meantime. So I started doing deliveries on the weekend so people can go on the website. And I've been doing brunch boxes and cookie boxes that people can order for, and they choose a delivery on Saturday or Sunday. They can still order cakes or anything else throughout the week. And one thing that's been huge that I've changed about the business is that I'm encouraging people to just bake at home. You know, we're all stuck indoors and we have some extra time in our hands. So maybe this is the time where you're going to pick up a hobby that you always wanted to try, vegan baking, but you never knew where to start or you didn't have the time. So I put together an ebook called Vegan Baking 101, and it's a beginner's guide to veganizing classic desserts. So you have your banana bread and blueberry muffins and vanilla cupcakes and a chocolate chip cookie. And those are all super simple recipes that really anyone can do. And you have all those recipes right there. You can do them at home, serve them to your family, anyone you're quarantined with, or just eat it yourself because times are rough and you need to treat yourself sometimes.
Sure. I like that. So now, of course, over time, if people get really into learning through your virtual baking instructions and your ebook and stuff, might you be putting yourself partly out of business by doing this?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I really think that people who love baking, they love eating baked goods. And
yeah.
I say that because I'm one of those people.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, once we, you know, go back to normal, we'll be having in-person classes like I was offering before. There's plenty of room. There's never enough cookies to go around.
Well, that's a philosophy to live by. So I think we're sort of just nearing the end of our time, Natalia, but let's people know how to get a hold of you online. So the website is CuriousCatBakery.com. So that's one key way. And then there's Instagram and Facebook and anything else that you want to let us know about how people can sort of get in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything, you just go to CuriousCatBakery.com. That's where you can order. You can message me. You can find the ebooks, the classes, everything in there. If you're on Instagram, Facebook, Pinterest, everything else out there, YouTube, it's Curious Cat Bakery.
Okay.
Feel free to send me a message. I respond to every single DM that I get, and I would love to hear from any of you.
Great. All right. Well, it was great speaking to you. This has been Natalia Lima, and again, her bakery is the Curious Cat Bakery. And one more time, the website is CuriousCatBakery.com. And Natalia, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. You have a great day.
We're going to step into the Comedy Corner for a brief, though thematically relevant, piece from the great Maria Bamford. Here's vegetarian Oscar Schindler by Maria Bamford on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I wish I could be a vegetarian, because I've seen all the horrible videos of those animals, you know, pigs lined up in front of their children and shot at close. I haven't seen that, but I imagine that's what the... I could never watch those videos. It looks so scary. But I would like to think that I'd be an Oscar Schindler in the face of a systematic genocide. But first they came for the ice cream cones, and I said nothing. Because I was not an ice cream cone. All right.
That was Maria Bamford with a short piece called Vegetarian Oscar Schindler, taken from her album Ask Me About My New God. We have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I invite you to return next Wednesday at 10 a.m. for another edition of the show. I also invite you to consider pledging in support of Talking Animals and WMNF overall in this, the final hour of the Sarasota Giving Challenge. Again, any pledge between $25 and $100 gets doubled by calling 813-238-8001. I also invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast and links to our social media. Stay tuned for Rob Loray and Radioactivity. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Largo, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, Weeki Wachee, and beyond.